Blog Talk Radio.
How's everyone doing this morning? I hope everyone is feeling as well as I am, especially after watching some football for the very first time for 2018. Thank you for tuning in to Lock and Talk. I'm your host, Barry Barnes, founder of CEO of Locker-Report.com. Thank you for joining me again. You know, it's always a pleasure, it's always an honor to have you listen to me every Friday. Well, I have a lot to get to today, and most importantly, I have a very special guest that's on the show. Going to join me right now, NFL legend, you know, Mr. Butch Johnson, who was definitely one of the best players for the Dallas Cowboy era in the 70s, wide receiver. And although he's not in the Hall of Fame, but he did make a Hall of Fame catch in Super Bowl 12. Mr. Butch Johnson, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you guys doing, man? Thanks for having me on.
Hey. Oh, no, it's an honor and a pleasure. Anytime I have someone of, you know, NFL legend, you know, come on to the show, although you're the first NFL legend to come on live, you know, it's an honor to have you come out, take your time out. I know you're very busy and everything, and jump right into it. Last night, the Hall of Fame game in Canton, which I just left from, covered last night, and I know that you're a small school guy. I know you went to a Division II school and was able to still have a success in the NFL as you went to California Riverside. When you see small school guys have an opportunity to play in the NFL, and you're one of the pioneers to help set that up, what's one of the first things that goes to your mind, or something you could say to those small school guys right before they actually take the NFL field?
Well, there's a couple problems with coming from a small school and playing football. I want to mention, you said you just came back from Canton from the Hall of Fame game. Actually, my rookie year in the NFL with Dallas, we played in the first Hall of Fame game that was held in the history of the NFL. So it was strange that that happened, that the first game they played in Canton, a Hall of Fame game they played in Canton, I played it. So, I mean, history is just amazing to me. Coming from a small college, the real biggest problem you have, you don't have the advantage of going to big schools. Because big schools, you get used to playing in front of large crowds. You get used to television cameras going around. You get used to people jumping up and down. You get used to how you work out in the gyms and all this stuff. But when you go to a Division II school, it's like you're in high school. And in some cases, it works because they don't have big gyms where you work out. They don't have big stadiums where you play. They don't have the best coaches in America. So you're really out there just playing, you know, it's just one step above playing at the high school level.
I'm sorry.
Well, and in some cases, it's even worse because even at the high school level, at least in the state of Texas, man, you'll see 10, 15,000 people at a game. At a Division II school, you'll see 4,000 or 3,000 or 5,000. So it's just, it's a different thing. You don't take a plane anywhere and play a game. You barely get on buses. So it's just a kind of a local college type of thing, just something for the college to kind of rally around. But there really isn't, it really isn't a big deal at the college.
Yes, sir, and working with small school guys, that's pretty much, I would say that's my niche. And last year in the NFL, there were 90 players that came from a Division II school. And a lot, several of those players are making a great name for themselves like you did. Now, most of those guys were undrafted. You got drafted in the third round. So this says a lot about how special you was to get picked from a Division II school to get into the NFL. One of the young men I talked to last night that I monitor, he played for Chicago Bears as a rookie, defensive tackle Abdullah Anderson, number 76. And last night when I talked to him in the locker room about how he settled down in the game, he basically said that, hey, he realized that I'm only playing a game that I've been playing all my life, football. When was that time when you got on the field, coming from the school that you came from, playing for the Dallas Cowboys? When was that? When did it hit you that you said to yourself, hey, I'm playing a game that I've been playing all my life? It shouldn't be that difficult.
Well, you know, I didn't see the difference, to be honest with you. It took me up until, like, my third year or fourth year to really realize where I was. And what happened was is that I was playing in New York. And matter of fact, we were playing the first time they opened up the New York Giants Stadium in Jersey. We played in that first game. And I was running back a punt, and I got hit. I got hit in a very dangerous position. And, man, I'm kind of walking off the field, and all of a sudden my mind just kind of woke up. So I'm sitting on the bench, you know, trying to recover from that blow. And Robert Newhouse walks up to me. He says, man, are you all right? And I said, yeah, I think I'm going to be all right. And I looked around, and I said, hey, man, there's cameras on this sideline, isn't there? Yeah, I didn't know there was cameras on the sideline because my focus was so much. Once I got on the football field, it didn't matter. I never saw the crowd. I never saw the cameras. I never saw I was focused on the fucking game. All that stuff was like a mirage. You know, you never see it. And then all of a sudden, oh, okay, it's there. It took me 3 years. He says, where have you been? And I'm like, well, I've been into the game. So when it all boils down, you know, the young man you were talking about is right. You know, for your first year or two, you're not looking at everything else around you. You're not looking at the parade. You're not looking at the crowd. You don't even see it. You don't even feel it. You don't even acknowledge it until years later down the road at that NFL level.
But you listen to right now to Mr. Butch Johnson, NFL legend, wide receiver, played 7 years for the Dallas Cowboys back in 1976 and 1983, played for the Houston Oilers in 84, and wrapped up his career with the Denver Broncos in 1984 and 1985. Mr. Johnson, you have one of the most iconic plays in NFL history at Super Bowl XII when you played the Denver Broncos. What was, I would say, when you see that highlight or when people, you know, your fans walk up to you and ask you about that play over and over, how does that make you feel knowing that you had an opportunity and a lot of NFL players didn't have a chance to do was to create a memorable NFL play and that will always be in NFL history?
Well, number one, let me correct the record. I played in Dallas for 8 years, and in that 8 years, we were in five NFC championship games, two Super Bowls, 20 playoff games in my life. And you for a short period of time, and you didn't complete everything. 3 years. So, so much help. Now, talk like you're talking about in the Super Bowl. Now, second year, I'm still your focus has to be just in the game. And in that game, you're not thinking about all those things. You're thinking about playing the game, hitting the plate, which is 15 years old. One thing about it never should have happened, and it should have happened. Look at my thumb in the first quarter. And they take the thumb together and then, you know, gave me something, took me to the locker room, gave me something. I went back out to play for three quarters. Now, I caught that ball with a broken thumb in the third quarter. So, in this day and age, I never would have come back on the field. So, number two, a play like that for a lifetime, if you're lucky. I'm really proud of it. I was fortunate enough to play with the team. Just had a great team. So I was playing for the team room to catch touchdowns in back-to-back Super Bowls.
Wow.
Away from it. So those are the athletes. But the timing, that catch, number one, I talked about the broken thumb. Number two is that this is had in the heart, Roger Staubach was the quarterback at the time, and he was kneeling on one knee, and he said, "Who's in here?" I said, "Well, Butch." He said, "Well, go to the post." Well, the post was a deep route, you know, going to the goalpost, and we were like 45 yards out. Well, I was supposed to run an in cut at about 17 yards. So I'm in my second year, and I'm nervous because I know Tom Landry, if you do the wrong thing, he's all over you. He will bench you on one play. You know what I'm saying? So, Rocky said, go to the post. I said, Rocky, I said, go to the end. I said, we're talking to the other. And he said, just go to the post. So, I'm going, I'm like, okay, here we go. So, I line up, and I'm on the weak side, and I'm going down the post. Well, if you know football, they were in a zone coverage, and they were deep thirds, which means Bernard Jackson was safety, and he went straight down the middle, and he went straight down. And you don't practice going a post into a cover three. You just, you know, you throw it underneath because the safety is deeper than everybody on the field. So that's something you don't practice. So I'm nervous because I'm a second year, and then I'm running down, so I got to disguise that I'm going to find Star Jack. And I just sprint to the ball. It was quite a one-shot deal where either I can pull my back because I know my tennis, I got to pull up the ball and jump back. And I know my bitch. So at the end of the day, I kept walking up the field, you know, like a peacock, because we're like, this is 45 yards down the field, and I'm trying to keep people from hitting my head. Be right to me. I said, come and go. And walked away. It was the play that he wanted to do. He didn't call. Roger called something. But that's on what's happening. Have time, you know, handle a game or who's behind you or who. The whole business, the focus between you, you get the focus on that, it's just not going to happen.
Right. And then the best thing about that whole scenario, that whole play, was that you was prepared, you know, for that moment, you know, despite the distractions and what was called, you was prepared. So it says a lot about you as a player. And it says a lot about you, how you approach everything. You can tell a lot. I can tell a lot from a great player like yourself, you know, how you carry yourself on and off the field. Mr. Johnson, I would love for you to come on the show sometime soon, like another couple of weeks, you know, where we can really talk, really get into the small school topic and how the league is improving to really target small schools. both of you, you're available in another couple of weeks, so we're going to jump into it. I want to say thank you so much for taking your time out today to join me here on Locker Talk.
I'm sorry I didn't get so much into the small school thing, man, but Dallas had a reputation of doing this for the last 50, 60 years and before the scouting department came into play. So anyway, thank you for having me on. And small school was their whole thing. That's where all their great players came from, was small schools.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, that's something that we, for the league, definitely got to get back into and get in touch with.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we'll be talking seriously, Josh. Trust me, you will.
Take care, and thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. This is Locker Talk. I'm the host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of Locker-Court.com, and you're listening to the Bachelor Pad Radio Network, where you'll find out about NFL stars of tomorrow, today. You can always shoot us at Locker-Report.com on Twitter, at Locker_Report on Instagram, LockReport100, or on Facebook at LockReport.com. Now, like I said, just, you know, I was covering the game last night in Canton, Ohio, watching the crowd and getting really into the mix. Everyone was getting fired up for the football season and all that, and also seeing their favorite players who will be inducted and enshrined, you know, tomorrow for the ceremony. So you had the Ravens fans that was there loudly supporting Ray Lewis. You had the Eagles fans there for Brian Dawkins. Chicago Bear Nation was in the house. Brian Urlacher, you know, to see that, you know, he's getting through on the first ballot along with Ray Lewis is something incredible to see. And then some other legends that was, you know, that's a part of it. It was a great atmosphere. The Terrell Owens situation, I don't know if anyone was thinking about that, but the Terrell Owens situation is, you know, it's well documented. You know, he's not going to attend. Although the hall, they basically still have his invitation there open. So if Terrell Owens decide tonight, midnight, that he want to fly to Canton, Ohio, he can actually still come and give his speech, you know, on Saturday. So that's how open the invitation is. And although the fans, the media, is very disgusted and feel slighted that he's not going to be there, the Hall of Fame committee has definitely taken the high road in this situation, because they did say from you know, talking to someone yesterday, that even after this whole thing is set up, is over, and Terrell doing what he's doing at Chattanooga, and everything's going normal how it is in Canton, Ohio, if Terrell Owens wants to be a part of anything for us with the Hall of Fame from then on, he's always welcome with open arms. So he's still going to be able to take part of ceremonies that they will have down the road with his gold jacket. So they're not going to take that away from him. Believe it or not, there's upset. You know, of course, it's a disrespect there from everyone else, but the committee still embraces him as a Hall of Famer, and also his, you know, the gentleman that made the Hall of Fame as well, they still embrace him. It's just unfortunate that he's not going to be there to take part of something that's very special, something that if he wanted to be catered to and he wanted to be heard, this was the time. This weekend was the time for him to write that shit, to say what he wanted to say, and be treated the way how he felt in his heart that he should be treated. This is unfortunate. He'll never get this opportunity again. And I do believe personally that he will regret it when he take part, if he decides to take part of the ceremonies down the road, and when he see how the other gold jackets talk to the new incumbents who will receive a gold jacket. I'm probably sure that he'll probably say in the back of his mind, he probably won't admit it, but he will regret not being here this weekend. Now, back to the most important thing for me, the game. And last night's game, and all the stars, you know, Lamar Jackson, rookie quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens, got out on the field, showed off, you know, fans wanted to see it. But I wasn't worried about Lamar Jackson. I was only worried about my guys from the regional combine. And one of the guys who I'm about to play his interview right now, his name is Abdul Anderson. Get familiar with that name. He's a rookie, defensive tackle for Chicago Bears. This is my interview with him in the locker room, and we'll wrap everything up about his performance after this. Oh, Okay, not a problem. We'll come right back to it, and the interview will kick in. I'm having some difficulties here for technology, but it's all right. It'll kick on in. But last night, it was very interesting to see how he came onto the field. He took the field. He started the second half of the game, the first series. And in the first series, you know, he was playing on the back of his heels, and Lamar Jackson got his first time coming on the field, getting an opportunity to play. And so Lamar Jackson coming on the field, the first thing he wanted to do was run. And everyone knows about his speed. Everyone know how, you know, how fast he is. So the Bears defensive front and led by Anderson played on their heels that first series, expecting him to run, which he did, but was trying to figure it out. Now, Anderson is a graduate from Bucknell. Anderson is highly intelligent. And from watching his first series and compared it from the series to the series after that, I really saw how he adjusts to the game and how he actually figured it out. And what he figured out was, how he said in the interview, which we'll hear shortly, was how he just said, look, I've been playing this game all my life. Nothing's going to change now. And so what he did was he made the pocket very uncomfortable because Lamar Jackson, when he came out, he started running, only went through one progression, started taking off. Lamar started to settle down himself and started delivering the ball pretty well in the pocket. In the pocket, another couple of run plays, getting him settled. But Anderson, that by forcing the pressure right up front, and when he started forcing the pressure right up front, Anderson had dictated where he wanted Lamar Jackson to go. So you have a nose tackle, defensive tackle, close to 300 pounds, start chasing after the speedy running back, quarterback. And it was something to see how he was able to adjust and how he was able to figure it out on the fly. And so after talking to him, basically after tonight's game and knowing the type of quarterback he had to go up against, although it's a preseason, but it will go a long way, and the confidence is definitely there. Another player that came through the pipeline is teammate Roy Robinson Harris. Roy Robinson Harris, he started the game for the Bears, and he quickly showed his explosiveness and his power. But pretty much right in the next series, that's when he got double-teamed pretty much for the rest of the game, the entire, you know, first half. And he was working his way around it, figuring that out. He almost had a sack, actually almost had a half a sack late in the second quarter when the Ravens had substituted Josh Woodrum into the game, and he was in a situation where he was trying to scramble, got tripped up, and that's when Harris came flying by and almost decapitated him. But thank goodness he don't hit the ground, because if he didn't, Harris definitely would have lit him up. You know, so they were the two guys from the regional combine last night that came through the platform that played. Starting the training camps this year, there are 108 players that came through the pipeline of the NFL regional combine. And I will touch on that right after this interview.
All right. Abdul Anderson, your first game in the NFL, what was it like?
It was amazing. At first, it went by real fast. And but me and my other defensive lineman, we came in. We said, "Look, we're gonna come out here, come out fast, come out strong, no matter what. Stick together and work as a team." And we did that.
Right. The first series, it was like you was a little unsettled. After that, it looked like you looked at what was going on. You really slowed the game down for yourself, and then that's all of a sudden you caused a lot of chaos. You closed the pocket down. Jackson couldn't roll out. You were hunting him down. Got your first NFL sack and tackle. What went through your mind from that first series? And how did that change the performance for the rest of the game?
It's kind of like that first year of college, you know. You get in there and you're thinking, and then all of a sudden you realize this is a game. This is football. You've been doing this. I haven't been doing it for long. I ain't playing high school, but yeah. You've been doing it ever since college. So once I figured out that, I got my first hit in against the offensive lineman. Then once that second series came in, I was like, all right, bet, I'm ready. I'm just going to do exactly what I did. This is why they brought me here. And I'm going to execute everything to the T and get after that quarterback just like I did.
What's some of the things that you can take away from the game tonight to get yourself better for the next game so you got to play for the rest of the preseason?
Start out fast. work hands even more within the scheme, and like you said, continue to close down that pocket, because if there's always a middle pressure, all my other teammates can eat, and that's the most important thing. As long as everyone's eating,
right,
that's when you start winning games.
Yeah. How much of an effect was going to that Invitational in Tampa? How much did that really help you to actually get on the team's radar, to actually get select or get signed by the Chicago Bears?
First of all, it was a great honor going down there. I appreciate all the people that gave me a chance to go down there. And it actually helped me out because, you know, Bucknell is a very small school. We had a draft pick last year, Julian Davenport. And just getting that exposure to more people, getting my name out there, them seeing me move within doing the D-line drills and stuff like that, it was a great opportunity to show my worth to teams and organizations.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, my man. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yes, this is Lock and Talk. You listen to Lock and Talk on the Bachelor Pad Radio Network. I'm your host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of Locker-Report.com. And that was Abdullah Anderson talking to him last night's game. Although they came up short by 1 point against the Baltimore Ravens, 17-16. But we know this is the evaluation stage of the season. And right now, he definitely have an A in his evaluation. Really looking forward to seeing what Anderson's going to do for the next four games. I think the coaching staff is very pleased with what he did last night, his performance, and I think it's going to show. Now, right before the interview, I stated that there are 108 players that came through the NFL Regional Combine platform that's currently on NFL teams now. Amongst that 108, we have five guys from the International Player Pathway Program, with five players from the UK that's a part of this program to learn the game of football. And they, all of them will be, except for one, Jordan, only one, Jordan Melitele, who actually got drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles in the seventh round. But the other four players, they primarily going to be on the practice squad, learning the game, learning the movement of the game. So they're pretty much more of a project. The AFC North is actually the pilot division this year. Last year, it was the NFC South, as they host four players on the practice squads within their four teams. Now, the players that came through the program last year, they have to earn their spot this year. And so amongst the four players that's going to be on a practice squad this year, they're going to learn the game. Next year, they got to earn the spot. So that's five from that 108 that's there. And then you have 17 rookies, legitimate rookies, that came through the Invitational this year, and Anderson is one of those guys there. And the rest of the players, were actually seven more players, came through another platform called the NFL Pro Player Combine. Pro Player Combine was designed for players that had played in the NFL within a year period of time, but want to get back in the good graces of NFL scouts. So they go through their own workout, you know, in front of the scouts, just like that, the Regional Combine Invitational, to try to get back on the NFL team. Last year, fullback for the Jacksonville Jaguars, Tommy Bohannon, he came through that process, had a successful, outstanding season last year, scored three touchdowns, and helped pave the way for the best rushing attack in the NFL. This year, one of the bigger names that came through the pro player is Keenan Reynolds. Now, you're familiar with him. He was the quarterback at Navy who got drafted by the Baltimore Ravens in 2016. Actually was converted over to a wide receiver. Didn't fully stay with the Ravens for a long period of time and found himself out of the league, but he went to the pro player. Now he's a member of the Seattle Seahawks, trying to make that squad this year as a wide receiver, knowing that Seattle Seahawks don't have a lot of depth there. It's a good chance that he may make that squad, and also to have an emergency backup quarterback. That's a situation that is very viable. Now he's at a team who needs a backup quarterback. Russell Wilson do have a backup, but knowing that Reynolds is there in a situation where they're going to need someone to step up to play the quarterback position, God forbid if something was to happen to Wilson, at least if Reynolds make the team, Pete Carroll will have someone that he can use in his bag of tricks. And the rest of the players, mounting out around 80 players from the Regional Combine that came through there, going all the way back to 2012, is still currently in the league now. Four of those guys are returning Pro Bowlers, and Adam Thielen, wide receiver for the Minnesota Vikings, who was actually the first player from the regional combine to actually get nominated, actually get voted by the players to be on the NFL top 100 players list, which is aired every year on NFL Network. And then you got Orlando Villanueva, left tackle for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Johnny Hecker, the punter for the Rams, and Greg Zuerlein, who was the kicker for the Los Angeles Rams. All four of those guys are Pro Bowlers. They're coming back this year. Greg Zuerlein is coming off an injury. He looked good in camp. He's ready to take his spot as pretty much like the best kicker in the league, because Hecker is the best punter in the league. Why not have those two kicking specialists all on one team? So that's the players there. I'll dive a little bit more into the players next week as they all these guys prepare for their first NFL football game. Thank you for tuning in to Locker Talk. I'm your host, Barry Barnes, founder and CEO of Locker-Report.com. Go to the site. You'll see the information that I'm posting up there. Check out the shows being uploaded on there. Check out the articles. I will have a preview about what happened at the Hall of Fame. Shoot me an email anytime, Barry Barnes at Locker-Report.com. Shoot me a message on Twitter, Locker_Report. On Instagram, Locker Report, all low caps, 100. Or to shoot me a simple message on Facebook at LockReport.com. Everyone stay blessed. Enjoy this football season.
This is Afroeconomics with J.B. Bryan. Afroeconomics is a strategic financial management program designed for the advancement of Black wealth in America and abroad.
Hey, 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 y'all. I tell you, the fearless entrepreneur is our discussion today. I get an email and the guy says that he's always wanted to own his own business, but his woman, he never married a woman who supported his idea. That's what the email says. Like he says he never married a woman. That means he's married more than one time. So I never married a woman that supported my idea of starting my own business. Well, I tell you, definitely not a fearless fella in that email. But I have to understand that because I hear that every day. People go, I can't get the support that I need. I was even listening to one of those motivational tapes, and I think that the singer Tyrese, he was talking about how that it's going to be the people closest to you. And in my book, I have a chapter, a whole principle of Afroeconomics is on the fearless entrepreneur, because I talk about dream killers. That's what he's talking about. That's what Tyrese is talking about through his career. That's what I can talk about through my career. I started my business in my 20s, and now I'm only, but I tell you, I started my business a long time ago. And that you're going to have people close to you, and they love you, but they want to protect you from the unknown. But we know that we have to be fearless. Now, I say that I believe that being fearless is the key to my success as an entrepreneur. Every day, I look for something that pushes me to the edge. Like the song said, push me to the edge, right? Pushes me to the edge. Something that challenges me, that even scares me. If I'm doing something and it scares me, I promise you, I'm going to do it. That's why, maybe because I love my Harley Davidson, I don't know, not to give them a commercial, but I love my bike. Now, because I guess when I ride my bike, I'm focusing more on staying up. Now, most people say, well, what if you go down? Now, I've been down, but I got back up. So that's what we have to be as fearless entrepreneurs, focus on staying up. So when I'm doing something that scares me for the business, say opening a new location somewhere that I've never been before. I'm from the South. And I have an office in New York City. Now, I can't even wake up early enough. Now, I think I'm an early riser because, I'm from the country and everything. But in New York, it's never early. They never sleep. And when they say the city never sleeps, it never sleeps. But going to New York and opening an office was facing something that scares me as an entrepreneur, but I know they need Afroeconomics in New York. So my desire to help superseded the fear that was trying to overcome me as an entrepreneur. The fearless entrepreneur, principle number 7 of Afroeconomics. So we want to first embrace the unknown. Be creative and find new ways to do what you do. I was telling a lady who helps me clean up my home, and I said, "Do you have a handyman?" And she said, "No, I can't think of anyone." And I text her back and I said, "You should find a handyman that will do work for your people, and then you get the override like these major companies do, because most major companies that you'll go to, they're using contractors." And you know, but that's being creative about the business that you're in, embracing that I don't do that work, but there's a lot of people that I serve that have that need, like me having relationships with people that prepare tax returns, right? Are working with people who are connected to what you do. But in embracing the unknown and figuring out a way to embrace the unknown that will help the people that you serve. It's not about me. That's the way I see it. When I'm afraid of something and I know it's going to help all the people that I know, then it's not about me. It's not about me. It's about me saying something, doing something, serving you with something, bringing some knowledge through Afroeconomics that's going to help you no matter what you do. As an entrepreneur, you have to be committed to knowing that I'm fearless. My fearlessness has to come from my desire to serve others. And a second point is to fall in love with rejection. Now, oh yeah, you've got good intention, but there's a lot of people who have absolutely no desire to allow you to help them. So fall in love with that. It's a beautiful thing. Fall in love with rejection. I started as a kid. I remember being a Girl Scout, and if somebody said, "Come back and bring the calendar the next day," I went back and did the calendar the next day. It's funny how so many people, when somebody says, "Come back later," they see that as a no. When they say come back later, I'm coming back later, and I'm coming back later, and I'm coming back later. This one lady, she bought almost all the calendars I had because she sent me away 10 times. And then the last time she said, "Little girl, I have got to buy the calendars from you. How many you got?" I only had like 5 or 6, whatever. She said, "Let me have them all because you are going to be something when you grow up." And I'm just thinking about this. I'm telling this story to you all for the first time. I've never told anybody this story before. Yes, indeed. And I got the trophy. I hope my mother still has that trophy for top sales as a Girl Scout. Yes, indeed. So fall in love with rejection. No does not mean no. No just might mean they're just not ready yet. Often people that you didn't even say no, but you see it as a no. When they say, "Well, I might need that next year," you see that as a no, and you never talk to them again. But that's a, "I need you next year." So you need to use the tools that you have. A smartphone is a smartphone, but only if you're smart enough to use it correctly. So if someone says, "Contact me next year," you need to be using some tool that you have to contact them consistently before the next year, and just stay in mind, in their mind. Stay in their mind. Be aware that that's not a no. They're just not ready for you yet. You can bless them later. So don't take a maybe as a no. Don't take a contact me later as a no. My point, fall in love with what you might see as rejection. Enjoy it. Grow from it. And my third point is to don't over prepare. A lot of people, especially entrepreneurs, we're guilty of this, that you'll allow yourself to become afraid, you just become frightened, your fears overcome you because you want to prepare so heavily for something. So you never actually share it with anybody because you go, "I'm not really ready, I don't have my business cards right." Now, you've been doing plumbing for 20 years and you don't want to start fixing toilets because for yourself? Because you don't have your business cards right? They don't even care about your business card. You got to get their number. You need to know where they live. They don't care about your business card. They're caring about your skill to fix their toilet when you got a broken toilet. So I'm not even oversimplifying it. I'm not even exaggerating the point that don't over prepare. When I started my business in 1995, I had no money. No money. The same week that I started my business, my lovely husband at that time said he didn't want to be married anymore. Not a week later. I'm talking about that very week. So what you have to do is say, I've got something I've got to do. That did not take me off track. If you look at your life and you say, well, oh, wow, this blip has happened, so I'm not prepared to go on. Now, I did question myself. When he said that, right there at week number one, I had to go find another place to live, and I had my office and my business all set up, and I could have given up and gone back to the firm and said, well, you know what, I changed my mind, but I didn't, because that blip in the road has to stay a blip in the road. You can see that blip as a time to park, but I saw it as a time to keep going forward. You have to push through. You have to realize that there's no way that you can prepare for something that's unexpected. And most things that happen to you as a business owner, you can't prepare for that. All you have to do is become obsessed with the idea of being the best at what you do. So every time something happens that is trying to take you off course as a business owner, that's when you really get in there. You really get in the lab, right? You get in there and do your work and become the best at what you do. When that happened to me, I said, well, damn, I better make this work. That's what it reacted. It's got to work. It has to. When you don't have anything, any option but to succeed, then you will succeed. Hey, when they say burn the boats, the boats sometimes get burnt for you. So you've got to move forward. You got to make it work. A fourth point is to know the definition of fearless. Know your definition of being fearless. To me, being fearless is facing a fear and accepting the challenge. So, of course, there's things I'm afraid of. But by facing it, I feel fearless. Because if I run away from it, then you're afraid. So you face it. And you do it anyway. I don't think it's about lying to yourself, which a lot of people are, I'm not afraid. I just don't want to do it. No, face it. Do what you've got to do. There are people who don't even look at their check statement because they're scared. They're just afraid to see what's going on in their bank account. Now, how can you as an entrepreneur think that you're going to succeed if you can't face the things that you're afraid of? So we have to bring these things. If I look at it just that every obstacle that you have, that if that is the thing that slows you down, if it's doing invoicing, or some people don't even like to charge people. They don't like to make their invoices. There's some people that do work for me and I have to make them send me the invoice now because they're afraid of billing me for the time that they spent with me. That you cannot succeed unless you get the money. You have to, whatever the fear is, you've got to do it. I would argue that a lot of our businesses go out of business because of not billing properly. The best time to bill someone is immediately. Face that fear. Remember my first sales job, and I went out and I got the sale. And then my boss said, well, where's the check? And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? I got the contract signed. He said, but where's the money? And that changed my entire life because that is truly the way to eat. You've got to get the money. So whatever your fear is, if it's asking for the money, you've got to get over it. You've got to face it, or you're not going to be able to serve the people that deserve to have your help. So don't expect people to just throw their money at you. It's not going to happen. Do them the service of making sure you give them the invoice correctly. Whatever the fear is, I'm just using it as an example because that's a lot for our businesses. A big problem is the billing. So to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to face your fear of whatever it is and do it anyway. So many people say to me, I'm just afraid to come talk to you. I have an entrepreneurship membership of Afro Economics because I feel that it is important for our people to have mentors, examples in business that can help them. I want to give you what I never had. And finally, I say, come to the field. Come on the playing field to win. Come on the playing field to win. Don't just do your business halfway. If you're going to do it halfway, and I have this in my book, you're blocking the opportunity for someone else. We know as Black entrepreneurs, you do not have the privilege of doing wrong and think that you're not impacting me. If you represent me with everything that you do. If you don't pay your bills on time, if you don't keep your word, if you don't call back your customers, when they see me, they're thinking I'm going to act like that. Now, we need to realize that you come to the field with winning in your heart, doing the best that you can, doing the best that you can. Don't come to the field and say, well, I'm going to half step this because I still have a full-time job that I do. Don't go in there and take that opportunity from someone who's in it to win it and giving it their 100%. Don't do that. I say burn the boat. There is no plan B. Do plan B is to go back to plan A and do it right. Do it right. So I tell you, never give up. That's my message as the fearless entrepreneur that I feel that I am. Let's never give up. Make a renewed commitment to excellence and read that chapter 7, the principle 7 of Afroeconomics, the fearless entrepreneur. You can do it. And I'm J.D. Bryan, and that's Afroeconomics Today and hashtag Afroeconomics. Today's podcast was powered by J.B. Bryan Financial Group, a registered investment advisory firm and the home of Afroeconomics in Virginia, Maryland, Washington, D.C., and New York. Don't forget to subscribe to Afroeconomics with J.B. Bryan on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and any other podcast directory. If you like what you hear, leave me a 5-star review. I'm J.B. Bryan, and that's Afroeconomics at AURN.com.
Hollywood Live Extra with Tanya Hart.
I'm Tanya Hart. Today, my guest is Tensie Taylor. She is author of a new book titled Bullied, From Terror to Triumph. It is a story of survival. Tensie is here to share her story and give some insight into how to cope with our current environment where too many children are in this situation. Tensie, welcome and congratulations on all of your accomplishments, especially this book. How are you?
I am doing well, and I appreciate you for giving me the opportunity to be on your show and to share about my book and resources that are available to help students who are being bullied and even the parents and administrators of school systems.
Right, exactly. Now, I do have to let everybody know that currently you are the Assistant Director of Black Alumni Association here at USC. You assist students with mentoring programs, and, you know, you started out kind of at USC, so you're back again in an administrative position, which is great. But let's get into the book. You know, I read the book, and it's so upsetting what has happened to you, and you're such an adorable person and woman and just so accomplished. But you were bullied from the day you walked into kindergarten for the next 13 years.
Yes, that's correct.
I mean,
first day of kindergarten. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you got to ask yourself, and I did some research, 1 in 7 students are either bullied or have been a victim of bullying from grades K through 12. An estimated 660,000 children miss school every day due to this fear of attack or intimidation. I mean, I could go on, and 83% of them are girls. What was it, do you think, now looking back over this and having a career in academia, what was it that first day in kindergarten that kind of set you apart that made that girl do to you what she did? And then we'll tell the story.
I think what it was I'm very petite. I'm a small person. And part of the research says that bullies pick on those people who are smaller than them. And so for the fact that it was the first day of school, the first day of kindergarten, this student didn't even know who I was. And I believe she singled me out because I was tiny. I had my book bag on, and we actually rode the same bus that day on the way to school, but for whatever reason, she had something against me and wanted to pick on me and bully me, but I think it was because at that time of my size.
This goes on for many, many years. But when we look at this, I want you to tell a little bit about the story. Here you are, cute little kindergarten girl. You've got your Barbie backpack on, as you said. And tell us exactly what this young lady did and what that led to in terms of other people watching and seeing that.
Yeah, so in August of 1992, I stepped off of the school bus, a young, eager, bright-eyed student, ready to go to school and learn, meet new friends, and this student comes out of nowhere, much taller than me, bigger girl, and she snatches my pink Barbie book bag off of my back, unzips it, and throws all of my belongings on the ground. So my pencils, pen, paper, a notebook, everything came tumbling down. And I just knew that at least one student would come to my rescue, at least to help me up or to encourage the bully to leave me alone. But no, a crowd gathered around me and they started laughing at me and pointing at me. And I believe that gave the bully even more fuel. And she stomped her foot in me and said, "I wish you would try something." And at that moment, I knelt down, I picked up all of my belongings, trying so desperately not to cry, placed everything back in my book bag, and sadly walked to my classroom in kindergarten. And that was my first day of being bullied. And then for the next 13 years, I was picked on not only for my size, but because of I was a straight-A student. Academics were very
right.
important to me. And then and there's a chapter in my book about being picked on by my own black race. It was a colorism issue because I was light-skinned and had long hair. People made comments about that because I made good grades. My parents didn't make a lot of money. They were teachers at the time, and so I didn't wear name brand clothes or shoes. So students bullied me for that, just a myriad of reasons. And what I always found so baffling is I was the student who tried to befriend these students. I wanted to help
right.
them with their homework, participate in group projects with them, but they just had such animosity towards me. They would make comments, "Oh, you think you're all that because you make straight A's. You think you're all that because the teacher likes you." And I just found that very perplexing because I was nice. I didn't bother anybody, and I just wanted to get along and be a friend.
You know, that's the really sad part of this. You brought up something, the whole colorism issue that we still try to ignore within the African American group, race of people, whatever you want to consider us. This is still prevalent today. I mean, I was in there before you. I came along a little bit before you. Same thing happened to me. People were always jealous because of my skin color and because of my hair and because I was a good student. Okay, 20 years later, you come along, it's the same story. If we look forward 20 years, there are kids who are going through the same thing today. How do we forget about everybody else? How do we stop this in our own race of people? How do we get over, you know, the colorism issue?
Having conversations, being open and honest with ourselves, teaching our young people to value the beauty in them. I saw an article a few years ago, this young lady named Karis, and she was bullied because of her skin tone. People made fun of her because she was dark-skinned, and her mother and her sister said, "Karis, you're a beautiful young lady. Don't let these students get to you." And so she turned that negativity into positivity and started this brand called Flexin' in My Complexion. And so she has her own T-shirt brand. She's modeled in New York Fashion Week. But it was, again, her own race of people who bullied her because of her skin tone. So
yeah.
I believe that instilling in our young people that you are beautiful and don't let anybody else determine your worth. And so when I go around, when I speak to young people and I speak at schools, I tell students, know you're smart, know that you're beautiful, that you're worthy, because when you believe in yourself and you have that self-worth, what other people say about you won't affect you as greatly. And the words from my classmates really bothered me because I had low self-esteem, and and so what they said to me, I believed it. But now if someone were to make fun of my complexion or they made comments about my eyes because they were big, they said I look like a frog, it wouldn't even faze me to this day because I know that I have beautiful eyes and I know my worth, and I'm not going to allow someone to make me feel bad about myself because I know that they're doing that because they are hurt and they have some type of internal jealousy. That's all it is.
Yes. Yeah, no, that is all it is. But when you were in fifth grade and you won every single award at your school because of your grades and your academic, you know, just acumen, and everybody shut you out, even some teachers. You know, it's one thing to say that now, but as a fifth grader, how did that affect you? And how long did it take you to get over? Oh, it had to have.
It did, and I credit my parents. They were such a strong support system to me. But when they read my book, they learned a lot of things that they didn't know because I didn't share a lot with them. Because when I was being brutally bullied, then I would tell them. For example, when a student tried to break my arm, I told my mom about that incident, and she handled it. But in other instances, I didn't because it made the bullying worse. The students would say, oh, you told on me, you're a tattletale, and I thought I hurt you or said something last time, I'm really going to get you now. And so that's why I encourage the young people to please find a friend, find a teacher, find an administrator, find a confidant, someone that you can talk to and confide in. Because at that young age, we're impressionable. We want to fit in. We want people to like us. And that's why so many young people now are committing suicide. And thank God I didn't grow up in the day of social media like a lot of young people today. I mean, I was watching Good Morning America a few weeks ago, and a young girl committed suicide because students were cyberbullying her, making fun of her, spreading nasty rumors about her. So people need to be more cognizant and aware of what's going on. But please, if you are feeling depressed or being bullied, talk to someone, because that way you keep it all bottled up. That's why so many people say, you know, I can't even go on with life anymore. No one cares. No one likes me. And then they take their life. But that's not true. Someone does care. And there is someone who likes you. Because I was in that boat when I was 16. I contemplated suicide. But thankfully, I didn't. And at that moment, I realized my worth. And I said, I'm not going to give these bullies the satisfaction of me taking my life, and then they go on with theirs. That is not fair. I am valuable. And then that's when I started to see the world differently.
Interesting. At age 16. And see, this is what I find, you know, like you said, because you were small, okay. You're light skinned, okay. You've got long hair, okay. And of course, you're the smartest girl in the class. At any time, did students just say, you know what, you got it going on, I want to be like you, and why do you think more people aren't like that? Because if you see somebody that's really achieving, personally, myself, I'm going to look at them and say, oh, I want to be like you. Why don't we see more of that?
And that's the mentality that I grew up in. That's how my parents raised me. I'm sure that's how your parents raised you. But what I learned with those students who bullied me, many of them came from broken homes. And so when the parent would come to the school yelling and cursing the teacher out, I understood why that student behaved the way he or she did. And as a psychologist who wrote the foreword to my book, Dr. Gloria Morrow, she says that hurt people hurt people. And so these bullies were hurt, and they wanted to hurt me. I grew up in a very loving, caring, compassionate background. I didn't grow up in a hurtful background, so I didn't have the desire to hurt anybody. But when you're so broken and you don't know what to do or how to overcome challenges, sometimes people get satisfaction in seeing other people hurt. And that's the reason why these bullies then say, oh, hey, Tensi, you're making straight A's, you're doing this, you're traveling abroad. What can I do to be like you? No, they felt less than, they were hurt, so to make themselves feel better, they wanted to bring me down. And funny, too, every summer I would go on a family vacation, and my mom would say, you know, if you want to take someone, you can. No student wanted to go with me on a family trip. I find that just mind-boggling.
Wow.
But they just had such animosity towards me because they were envious, but they just did not want to be a part of me.
Oh, my goodness. It's just, sometimes it's just hard to believe some of this stuff. I want everybody to know that you're listening to Hollywood Live Extra. I'm Tanya Hart. My guest today is Tensi Taylor. Tensi's a native of North Carolina, graduated from North Carolina State, has a new book out titled Bullied, From Terror to Triumph. You have certainly triumphed, Tensi, being at USC and helping students out there. I want to talk a little bit about that. But if we look at some of the things that people can do, because right now we are living in an environment, I don't need to even talk about it, in this country where, you know, the biggest bully is the man who's supposedly running the government, Donald Trump. Donald Trump is one of the biggest bullies other than being a con man, he is a big bully that I've ever seen, and people seem to tolerate that. Why do you think people are tolerating this? And especially at a time when we are trying to help our children and teach our children not to do it. Why do we continue to tolerate this man?
I think people continue to tolerate this man because it's just very, it's an interesting time that we live in today, because he has brought out the worst in people. People have just, I feel like bullying's at an all-time high now because of him. As you mentioned, he's out here bullying people, and the world sees it and making derogatory comments. It's just, we're extra on an all-time high today, and I don't know why people tolerate it. Sometimes it's fear. When I was being bullied, I tolerated it for so long. Why? Because I was afraid, and I thought mm-hmm. that if I said something, that the students would beat me up. And there have been stories where a student is attacked in a bathroom, and students are pulling out cell phones, videoing it. Nobody's stepping in to help, and then someone dies. That's what I don't understand. It's like,
I don't
you, instead of running to help, you want to pull out your cell phone to film. And this
yeah,
is the society we live in.
Well, you know what? You are so right. But there are some things that you can do now. I know, you know, if you're a young, and we're really speaking to the kids, because so many kids are going through this, way too many. You've just discussed how you protect your feelings from name-calling and hurtful behavior. You got to have it in yourself to do that. How do you speak up for someone, though? What would you suggest as somebody who's in that crowd? Because, you know, there are young people in the crowd watching, maybe even videotaping, and they feel badly because they know they should do something, but they don't know what to do. What should they do?
It's tough to speak up, especially when you're at a young kid. As I said earlier, you want to fit in. But if just one person speaks up, that can make the world of difference. You don't always have to follow the crowd. A lot of people today want to follow the crowd, and sometimes that leads into very serious situations. If you are that one student who stands up to someone that's bullying someone else, you can make a difference. You can maybe impact and encourage other students. Hey, such and such stood up to this bully. Maybe next time I can stand up. It takes being an ally. When someone sees that another person is on their side and cares, it can make a world of difference. And then I encourage the teachers, administrators, if you see incidents of bullying, to please report it and take it seriously. When I was being bullied sometimes during school, teachers didn't take it seriously. My mom and dad had to go all the way up to the superintendent's office one time because I was being bullied by a teacher. And it shouldn't have to go to that highest extreme. If an adult witnesses students participating in behavior, they shouldn't say something, because you can definitely save a life. And just teaching character development, teaching students how to treat one another, to be kind. I'm working on, we're talking to different people about enacting legislation. And yes, that will help, but I just think we need to learn as a generation to be kinder to each other.
I absolutely agree. But you know something, at some point it comes down to making a law that people have to follow, because that's sometimes the only thing people will really respect, is some kind of a law. So I'm glad to hear that. And what would this law involve, or this legislation?
It would involve very beginning stages, but it would involve holding the students accountable. Because oftentimes when I've talked to people, so when a student is being bullied and she reaches her breaking point, you know, she might fight back. And then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. the student who's being bullied is being suspended. But it's not fair to that student, because the student was defending themselves and they had been bullied for so long. So one of the legislation that I've been talking about is this policy of restorative justice. And so that's something that different legislators are thinking of doing. Different conversations have been talking about that. But
good.
I think that if we were to get a law, that people would take it more seriously, because you can have all the curriculum in the world and you can try to teach kindness, but some students don't want to listen to that. If you have to bring the law into it, then they probably will take it more seriously.
I think you are absolutely correct. You are definitely on the right track here, and just a wonderful, inspiring person yourself. Now, where can people find you, and where can they find the book?
Yes, so they can find me on social media. I'm on Instagram at Tensie Taylor. on Twitter at Miss MS Tensie, T-E-N-S-I-E, and then I have a Facebook fan page, Tensie J. Taylor, and the book is available online through Amazon, Books A Million, and Barnes & Noble, and for those people who want to follow me through social media, please do. I reach out. I respond to messages. People from all over the world have read my book and have reached out to me, and what I find most interesting is when I've had several people who admitted to being bullies in school, and they said, Tensie, after reading your book, I never knew how I was hurting so many people with the way I was being bullied. They went back on social media and found the people that they bullied and apologized because they didn't realize how hurtful their actions were at the time. They were just like, hey, kids, no, that's not how it is. Like, you, somebody's words and actions can really cause someone to take their lives. It is that
serious. Oh, it is that serious. Tensie, thank you so much for sharing your story and really this important information. I mean, we've got to make a lot of changes. This is certainly one of them because you're right. Once people are kinder to each other, they'll be kinder to themselves and that'll even make a difference. You know what I mean? It's like it just, that's the way it works.
Yeah, so thank you again, Tanya. I appreciate you.
Oh, no problem. I want everybody to know they're listening to Hollywood Live Extra. I'm Tanya Hart. My guest has been Tensie Taylor, who has this incredible book out. You got to check it out, especially anybody who is a parent that needs to know how to deal with bullies. And even if your child isn't being bullied, you should read this book because there's some great stories in here. Tensie, thank you. Come back anytime.
Anytime I'm here.
And don't forget to subscribe to Hollywood Live Extra on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Make sure you download all of these shows because you don't want to miss any of them. If you like what you hear, leave a 5-star review. I'm Tanya Hart. This is Hollywood Live Extra at AURN.com.
Hollywood Live Extra, a product of American Urban Radio Networks.